Hello there. Today is Tuesday, April 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, France's president begins his official state visit to the U.S. Tragedy in Toronto as a van plows into a crowd of people.
He just went on the sidewalk. He just started hitting everybody, man. He hit every single person on the sidewalk. Anybody in his way, he would hit.
Is it a ruse, or is North Korea really ready to play nice? Also ahead, there's a new addition to Britain's royal family. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump welcoming French President Emmanuel Macron to the White House Monday at the start of a three-day state visit, during which the two leaders have scheduled a mix of official meetings and social events.
We're very, very happy and honored to be here with my wife, Brigitte, at the invitation of President Trump and Melania. This state visit is very important for our people and very important for us.
Shortly after his arrival, the French leader and his wife, Brigitte, Trump and his wife, First Lady Melania, planted a European sessile oak sapling on the south lawn of the White House, a gift from the Macrons. The tree comes from Belleau Wood, where more than 9,000 American Marines died in a 1918 World War I battle on French soil as Allied forces fought German troops. Joining us now for what to expect from the visit is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what's the reaction you're hearing from the people of France?
From the French perspective, they regard it as a necessary part of the work of being the president that you go and talk to everyone. This idea that France has to talk to everyone is something that's really ingrained. So, you know, the idea that just because most of the public don't like Donald Trump, and the latest opinion polls show that 9 out of 10 French voters dislike Donald Trump, that's got nothing to do with it. They like the fact that President Macron goes and talks and beats the drum for France, beats the drum for Europe to this particular president.
And one big topic that is definitely on the agenda for certainly Macron, he's been making statements even leading up to this trip about the importance of President Trump not pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. I know that he feels very strongly about it. Will he be successful? And what are some of his arguments?
Well, the main argument from not just the French side, of course, also other signatories to this agreement, Germany and the United Kingdom, are saying, look, yes, there are problems with this multinational nuclear agreement that everyone signed with Iran. There are problems about the ballistic missile program. What Emmanuel Macron, though, is saying is don't throw the whole deal away just because of that, because that will provoke a lot of instability in the region and will unleash forces that will be way worse than this. So what Emmanuel Macron is going to say is, let's have some sort of supplementary agreement. Do not throw this out on May 12th when the deal comes up for either keeping it or abandoning it. Have a look at it, see what other supplementary agreement can come up with, and do it around there. Because really, as far as Emmanuel Macron and the French foreign ministry are concerned, just, you know, throwing it out the window or will not have the reaction that everyone will expect. It will have the opposite. It will have Israel and Iran again front and center at the security of the Middle East and of the Gulf will really be in peril.
Right. And of course, it also sends a message to North Korea, where the president is preparing to talk to Kim Jong-un about an agreement to abandon his nuclear program. But if we don't keep our promises when we make deals, that could also be detrimental. Would the French blame Macron if he can't convince Trump?
No, they wouldn't blame Macron. The French public are well aware, as of the foreign ministry, that yes, Emmanuel Macron may have the best relationship of any foreign leader with President Trump, but they do know that, you know, there are hawks who have more of an ear of President Trump than Emmanuel Macron would ever have. So they're well aware that Emmanuel Macron is just one voice of many speaking to President Trump. But you're quite right. There is the concern in Europe that if America pulls out of the Iran deal, well, then what sort of weight will any type of agreement have that America hopes to come to with North Korea if, when they see it, they say, oh, look, within years at best, you're going to walk away from the table.
Okay. Well, the other big issue, of course, is the tariffs that the president is planning on imposing. And I know Macron's definitely not happy about that.
He's not happy about that. And again, it's not just Emmanuel Macron who's going to say this. He actually carries on his shoulder the concerns of most of Europe's steel-producing countries, particularly Germany as well. They do not want to have any type of trade war. They do not want these tariffs to be put in place. And even though the European Union has got ready to click in a whole range of sanctions, economic sanctions against some American goods, if these tariffs do come up, they are still hoping that at the end of the day, Emmanuel Macron is the man who can work. If there's any pixie dust going around, they think he will be able to spread it around and get some sort of deal for Europe.
And so, Catherine, are the French expecting big results from this visit?
The French foreign ministry are really playing it down. They're going for the symbolism rather than substance. You're going to get a lot of symbolism reminding them that this is a very long-standing relationship that France has had with the United States of America. But the key that they're looking at now is really they want to see a sort of a perspective. Joint goals is what they're talking about, joint objectives, and remembering that this is a relationship that goes back centuries, well before Donald Trump, and hopefully by these gestures of tree plantings, it's a relationship that will go on for many centuries to come.
That's Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Thanks for being with us. A white Ryder rental van killed at least 10 people and injured more than a dozen others when its driver plowed through a busy Toronto, Canada sidewalk on a sunny Monday afternoon. Toronto Deputy Chief Peter Yoon talked to reporters after the tragedy.
The driver's in custody right now, and he's been investigated to the events that took place this afternoon. I also want to offer my condolences to the families and the victims of this tragic event that took place.
The incident occurred just before 1:30 p.m. as large crowds of office workers were on their lunch breaks. At least one witness described the driver as appearing to deliberately target victims on his roughly 1.6-kilometer-long rampage.
It was just while he was in the middle of the intersection, and the van just went right into him, plowed right into him. And then apparently he drove down further, and he went onto the sidewalk by the next building, and he hit more people there and just kept going.
A U.S. security source said there's no reason to believe that the incident was an accident. VOA's Victor Beatty talks to Nelson Wiseman, professor of political science and director of the Canadian Studies Program at the University of Toronto.
In a way, Canada's been girding for something like this because it's happened in a number of Western countries. My surprise is that the person who's done this, I thought that, this is obviously calculated. It's not an accident. And my initial instinct was, well, maybe as in France, as in Germany, it was a Muslim. But it appears to have been a Christian Armenian. And in light of the video we've seen, the way he was taken down by police, I'm not sure this was politically motivated. He may be mentally disturbed because, he kept yelling, shoot me, hit me in the head. He kept raising his hand as if he had a pistol, which he didn't. And that's the image I saw in the video. So this suggests to me someone is disturbed. We'll learn more in coming days. One of the things about the Canadian authorities, as opposed to the American authorities, is they're much more guarded about the information they release. As with the Americans, they tend to exaggerate the role of their own security and police forces. But overall, the Canadians are more guarded. We've had attacks in Canada in the past. It was just over a year ago that six Muslims were killed at a mosque in Quebec City, and a number were injured. But this was, this was violence against Muslims. This situation does not seem to be related to Islam in any way, but we'll find out more as the days go by.
Is there a large Armenian population in Canada?
It's not unusually large. As in the United States, the Armenian community has done quite well in Canada as in the United States, and is accomplished in many fields, Armenians are.
Do you think something like this could have been inspired by what happened in Europe and the U.S.?
No, I don't think it is, only in the sense that it's the use of a vehicle, but not in terms of the any sort of political motivation. But because we've been seeing vehicles weaponized, I think that has captured some people's imagination. The other thing I would point out is this, as in Europe, this wasn't a shooting incident, you see, because there are strict gun controls in Canada. This isn't to say that there aren't guns floating around, and long arms like rifles can be legally held. They've got to be registered. But when it comes to handguns, there are a lot of restrictions, although there are a number floating around illegally because they're brought in from the United States and easily brought across the border.
That's Nelson Wiseman, professor of political science at the University of Toronto. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Former U.S. President George H.W. Bush has now been admitted to the hospital. A California charity is helping educate youngsters in conflict zones. The Islamic State militants slay three brothers in eastern Afghanistan. And Zimbabwe police vow zero tolerance for election violence. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. Ahead of a planned summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Monday that North Korea won't be getting sanctions relief until it takes concrete action toward denuclearization.
Certainly, we're not going to make mistakes from previous administrations, and we're not going to take the North Koreans simply at their word. Like I said before, the maximum pressure campaign is going to continue until we see concrete actions taken by, look, we're not naive in this process. We've seen some steps in the right direction, but we have a long way to go.
On Saturday, North Korea announced it will close its nuclear testing facility and suspend nuclear and intercontinental ballistic missile tests. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis also on Monday said he's hopeful about talks with North Korea following the announcement.
Right now, I think there's a lot of reasons for optimism that the negotiations will be fruitful, and we'll see.
The North's announcement comes ahead of Friday's historic inter-Korea summit between Kim and South Korea's President Moon Jae-in. Kim is expected to meet with Trump in late May or early June. Tufts University Korean Studies Assistant Professor Sung Yoon Lee isn't convinced Kim is really making concessions.
Kim Jong-un, his mere utterance that he will retire his nuclear test site in the northeastern part of his kingdom, the Punggye-ri test site, and the fact that Kim is amenable to nuclear negotiations and a moratorium on ballistic missile tests, none of this I can call any kind of concession. The mere utterance of abstention from forbidden activities, activities that are prohibited under more than 10 UN Security Council resolutions, does not a concession or change of heart make. So I would argue that Kim Jong-un has given nothing so far. He's simply put on a happier face and has already wrested away from the U.S. and South Korea and other powers in the region some major concessions. The willingness on the part of the heads of state of these big countries in the region to meet with Kim Jong-un quite eagerly and therefore legitimate the North Korean dictator.
Also on Monday, in another sign of thawing relations, South Korea halted the propaganda broadcasts it blares across the border with North Korea, aiming to set a positive tone ahead of the first summit in a decade between their leaders. Well, after a massive manhunt involving many law enforcement agencies, the suspect in a quadruple homicide at a Waffle House restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee over the weekend was captured by police Monday. They recovered a handgun when they arrested 29-year-old Travis Rhine King. His right to own guns was revoked by Illinois authorities after he was charged with unlawful entry at the White House last July. A federal official Monday said Ryan King's father could face charges for returning those guns that were taken from his son after an incident last year at the White House. Joining us now to talk more about the legal trouble his father might be in is Los Angeles criminal defense attorney Lisa Hulley. What do you make of what this federal agent is saying?
The United States code section that the agent is referring to talks about knowingly selling, giving, or transferring a firearm or ammunition to a person who is a member of the, you know, prohibited class of persons. In this case, it is somebody who previously was adjudicated as either mentally defective or had been perhaps committed to a mental institution.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that we as the general public have all the information that the ATF has.
The 29-year-old's right to own guns was revoked by Illinois authorities after he was charged with unlawful entry at the White House last July, demanding a meeting with President Trump. So Illinois authorities ultimately returned the guns to his father, who subsequently gave them back.
Right. And then the father purportedly, yes, gave them back to the son. So the issue is going to be, you know, whether he knowingly allowed access to his son, knowing that he was prohibited from possessing or owning those firearms. So that's going to be the first thing that the federal agents are going to have to investigate, and then ultimately a prosecutor will have to decide whether they think that they have enough evidence to prove liability for the father.
What kind of punishment could that father face?
Up to 10 years in federal prison.
Wow.
Now, whether or not he'd get that full 10 years, it is too soon to know. But according to the code section, it does have a maximum punishment of 10 years.
Do you think this is a gun issue or a mental health issue or both?
I see it as an issue of both mental health and gun. There has, as we all know, been a lot of debate about guns and who should have access to them and what types of guns people should have access to, or whether there are some that should be prohibited entirely in terms of possession by just average citizens. But I think in this case, it just screams of the mental health issues. This young man obviously has had prior incidents that raised red flags about his mental condition, and some of the reports indicate, you know, bizarre behavior, which again sort of causes people to say, is there something else going on, like a mental illness? That's why I think that this really, there's a lot of crossover between both mental health and gun issues.
So if this young man was known to have mental health issues, would that help him legally in any way to avoid a stricter punishment? Or given the fact that there are now four people dead and quite a few more hospitalized?
I think what you're getting at is legal defenses. And the one that would come to mind in a case like this is insanity, and whether the insanity defense would apply. Generally speaking, insanity can be raised if his attorneys think that as a result of a severe mental disease or defect, the defendant was unable to appreciate the nature or wrongfulness of his action. You know, again, I think it's a little too soon to know the full story and to understand his full mental issues, if any. You know, has he been treated in the past? Has he been diagnosed? Is there evidence to support such a defense in this case?
That's Los Angeles-based criminal defense attorney Lisa Hulley. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, we discuss the various tactics that the Kremlin uses to wage political warfare in Western democracies and how to combat it with Alina Polyakova, Senior Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, a subject we don't hear a lot about, but one that mental health advocates say is becoming a growing epidemic in the United States, suicide. Close to 45,000 people die by suicide in America every year. But there are new methods that are helping nurses, teachers, and other professionals identify troubled individuals before it's too late. Joining us now is Jennifer Spiegler with health simulation company Cognito, which uses virtual humans to train professionals how to spot and treat people at risk.
Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, and there's a question as to what portion of deaths by opioid drug overdoses are actually suicide. So it's probably a higher number than we even know. So we think that there's probably an underreported number of suicides in this country. Suicide is more common than traffic death fatalities.
It's one of those things that you hear about it when it happens to someone like Robin Williams or a big celebrity that everybody knows of, and it's shocking, right? Because you just wouldn't have thought that that person was even struggling.
Part of the reason that we don't appreciate the number of suicides is because it's so highly stigmatized. Even still, mental health issues are becoming maybe less stigmatized, but there's still a lot of stigma out there, especially around suicide and taking one's own life.
So what is being done to help professionals help people before they get to that point where they feel that much despair that they take their life?
A very high number of people who take their own lives have seen a health professional within the last 30 days before they do that. So there is a concerted effort in this country and a movement that's been developed around the idea of zero suicides in healthcare, and that healthcare is a place that can really pull together and address suicide as a community, whether that's emergency departments, mental health providers, primary care providers, to connect all of those dots from a suicidal individual through their care. So there's a lot that's being done in that arena. And of course, there's a lot being done also to address youth suicide, primarily through schools.
Statistically speaking, are the number of people who are committing suicide, is that going up?
Yes, the number of people who die by suicide is going up.
Is it substantial, and has it been just in recent years?
It's substantial. Highest rate of increase is among women, although the greatest number of deaths by suicide is among men in the middle years. Different states have different rates of suicide. They tend to be much higher in the western states where there's more access to firearms. Firearms are the most lethal in terms of suicide completions. Mm-hmm. So you tend to see higher rates of suicide completions by men across the spectrum because that's the preferred method of suicide.
Some of the methods that are being used to help professionals identify troubled individuals before it's too late, are they successful or is there still a ways to go here?
There's definitely a ways to go. But in the work that we do, and we've trained, for example, about 500,000 teachers and tens of thousands of healthcare professionals, part of it is being able to identify someone who is possibly thinking about ending their life, but having a conversation with them where they will actually reveal their suicidal ideation or their plan, and then having that conversation to enable them to seek care or motivate them to seek care. So we here at Cognito have developed a series of online role play simulations where the learner gets to actually practice asking someone if they're thinking about taking their life. And that's a hard question sometimes to wrap your mind around, but it's one that has been proven not to put the idea of suicide in someone's head. So asking someone if they are thinking about ending their life is not going to make or increase their suicidal ideation. And if you're a physician and you give somebody the opportunity to actually tell you that you've considered ending your own life. It's the first step in connecting them to care. And by not overreacting, it gives that professional the opportunity to address the individual's thoughts and feelings and put them in the hands of a mental health practitioner, for example, who can help them work through what they're going through.
That's Jennifer Spiegler with health simulation company Cognito. Thanks for sharing that information with us. Well, in the UK, a town crier had a big announcement Monday.
Buckingham Palace, proudly announced the birth of a newly born royal prince on this St. George's Day, AD 2018. God save the Queen.
The Duchess of Cambridge gave birth Monday morning to a new prince who is fifth in line to the British throne. And before that, and before you knew it, she was home by supper time. Charles de Ledesma has more from London.
Kensington Palace says the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate, has given birth to her third child, a boy weighing 8 pounds, 7 ounces. The palace says the child was born at 11:01 British summertime, a few hours after Kate was admitted to London's St Mary's Hospital in labour. Prince William was present at the birth of his son, who is fifth in line to the British throne. The palace says the Queen, the Duke of Edinburgh, the Prince of Wales, the Duchess of Cornwall, Prince Harry and members of both families have been informed and are delighted with the news. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Well, the infant's name, which has been subject to a flurry of bets, is likely to be announced in the next few days. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In his speech to the Summit of the Americas, Vice President Mike Pence warned, "The greatest corruption of government is when the people lose their voice, their vote, their freedom, and their basic human rights under the heavy hand of dictatorship." This is particularly true in Cuba, where a tired communist regime continues to impoverish its people and deny their most fundamental rights. The Castro regime has systematically sapped the wealth of a great nation and stolen the lives of a proud people, said Mr. Pence. The United States has taken decisive action to stand with the Cuban people and to stand up to their oppressors. Cuba's dictatorship has not only beset its own people, noted Vice President Pence, but has also sought to export their failed ideology across the wider region, including aiding and abetting the corrupt dictatorship in Venezuela. Not long ago, Venezuela was one of the hemisphere's richest nations. It is now among the poorest. Venezuela was also once a flourishing democracy. It is now collapsed into dictatorship and tyranny. Clearly, said Vice President Pence, the responsibility for the Venezuelan people's suffering can be laid at the feet of one man, Nicolas Maduro. Today, nearly 9 out of 10 Venezuelans live in grinding poverty. Food and daily necessities are often impossible to find. Hospitals lack the most basic medical services and supplies, putting lives at risk and causing untold misery and death. And every day, some 5,000 Venezuelans flee in the largest cross-border mass exodus in the history of the hemisphere. In response, the United States has imposed strict financial sanctions on more than 50 current or former senior Venezuelan officials. The United States has also cut off Venezuela's digital currency from the United States financial system. Vice President Pence announced nearly $16 million more of assistance for Venezuelans fleeing their country. This is in addition to the $2.5 million pledged last month. The United States believes now is the time to do more. Every free nation in the hemisphere must take stronger action to isolate the Maduro regime. The United States will not relent until democracy is restored in Venezuela and the Venezuelan people reclaim their birthright of liberty.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.